everyone. Yes, last weekend we were in here celebrating the beginning of Paul Kogel's intervention in the House of Kettle's Yard. And it's extremely nice to gather again in quite a moment. But you all haven't had the chance to see through the house and see what he has been doing, and to hear what he has to say about the whole operation, and to do so in a conversation with Roger Wilson. This project originated in the early part of last year. Paul had an exhibition at the Eagle Gallery in London. I'd been very familiar with his work for a long time, but that exhibition really did suggest that Paul's sensibility, his interests, and the work that he was doing at this time really would play off extraordinarily with Kettle's Yard. His work very much to do with the domestic, with the stuff that we live with, and that sense of the object and its presence and its absence and the implications that it has for lived in and not lived in spaces seemed to be particularly poignant. So we talked soon after that exhibition, or during it, and soon Paul was launched on a series of visits to Kettle's Yard, with which he was already familiar, and getting to know it better and thinking through what might be done here. And what's happened has been something way beyond my wildest dream, in that I think the whole year has just been devoted to this project, and it's an extraordinary range of work which has been produced and which has found its way into the house seamlessly, and we're tremendously grateful to Paul for that. For us, it's particularly important to have artists engaged with the house at Kettle's Yard. As you know, Kettle's Yard was created more than 50 years ago. Jimmy Ead left here in 1973, and Jim's intention was not that Kettle's Yard should become a period piece, should become a National Trust home. His hope was that it would maintain a sense of contemporaneity, it would continue to get people looking and thinking afresh, and Paul's contribution is a very significant one in that process. So may I introduce Paul, who's had a haircut since I saw him last, and Roger to pass it.
You don't know that, do you? Well, that could have been. We've had a brief conversation before. You'll be relieved to know. So we have kind of shaped this conversation, but we also want to leave some space towards the end for you to actually to come into it and to ask your questions and make your comments. But what I wanted to talk about first was the place, and I'm grateful to Paul for inviting me to come here today, because I've not been here for a while. I mean, while meaning years. And it's a delight to come back, and it's a delight to test my memory of what I saw then, what I recall from then, to what I see now, the way I relive the space. It also made me think that in the intervening time, I've seen a lot of galleries, a lot of museums, a lot of different settings for art, and the language of art from Jim Ead's time to now, in a curatorial sense, has changed a lot. There was no such thing as installation, probably, when he started. There was no such thing as an intervention in public space in the way that it's understood now. So the curatorial practices and the assumptions about how you bring work to a place and what that might mean for an audience have shifted an awful lot during that period. Since I stopped overworking for a living at Chelsea, I've had a chance to go and look at quite a lot of museums around the country, and I've seen the new edifices of Walsall and Middlesbrough and in the north or the east in the Baltic. I've also revisited some smaller places, some municipal galleries and houses that have housed work in various parts of the country, including here and including the South West. And it seems to me there's also kind of break between a kind of corporate architectural approach to the display of art and a much more kind of immersed notion of what art might mean to the viewing public in a far more localised sense of a personalised experience. In that sense, this place looks like it's caught midway between a house that maybe wanted to be a gallery or a gallery that wanted to be a house. And there's a rather useful book I found when I was at Chelsea involved in real estate business called How Buildings Learn. And it talks about the way that certain kinds of architectural approaches lend themselves to the influence of the practices that follow, the domestic, the professional, whatever else happens. But the way the buildings themselves are open to, if you like, change and influence that comes to them. And I felt when I came here straight away that it was a place that was caught in a moment, rather than completed, rather than it had become a certain kind of place and had been something else. But actually it was halfway between what was and what might be in the future. That's my own look, Paul. I think I still feel that story just looking around me as I am there.
Well, I mean, one of the things that immediately struck me about Kettlesyard is that it's its domestic setting and its invitation to look at art in that domestic setting. I think it's also, as Roger pointed out, worth remembering that most artists from the period of the 40s, 50s, early 60s would have been actually making work for domestic situations. You couldn't live off waiting for the Tate to buy your work. For the most part, they'd buy it when you were dead, so it only helped your families. But there was most of the British art from that period was very much dependent on a few domestic collectors, and they weren't putting their collections in great purpose-built galleries. These would be exhibited in their homes, and it would be sort of, organic. I think, another point that Roger's made about the fact that the Kettlesyard is a place in transition. It is about the idea of gathering stuff. A lot of the stuff here has been donated by artists to Jim Mead. And the collection has sort of gradually evolved. It's not a collection that was made and then housed. And I think that is very, very interesting, because for me that connects with what actually happens in my own home and the way things accrue and things like that.
So it's like, in a way, it's like the treasured piece of furniture you can't move.
Yeah.
Because someone was there when made. Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
The scale of things is important, isn't it, in that sense, too? It's to do with the kind of possessed, the handmadeness of it.
Yeah. I think in our conversation earlier, Roger made a very good point about the handmadeness of what actually happens in Kettlesyard. I mean, this isn't... You do get the feeling that Jim's hand is all around. And in fact, there's lots of things that are rather hidden, where little contraptions for turning a sculpture around, where there would be a couple of ball bearings in an old tobacco tin that would serve as a thing to enable a sculpture to rotate. And there's evidence of that around. This isn't something that has been done in a corporate way with a sense of unifying everything. And that's something that really drew me to it. The other thing is something that I mentioned in the catalogue, which is really, really special, and I hope it always remains so here, is that you can sit in the chairs. And so Kettlesyard is an invitation to look, and it's an invitation to contemplate relationships, spaces, and other things in a way that is very, very rare. Most public houses or museums invite you to look from a certain distance and look standing up. And I've always been interested in that sort of expression, I'll grab a seat, which is an invitation to engage in a very different way. I remember years and years and years ago having a friend in Lancashire, and they had an expression, something like that, you get your feet under the table. And this was meaning it was a way of actually ingratiating yourself within the family, but also becoming part of something else. But I think Kettle Shard offers that invitation.
I use the term man-madeless. I'm sorry. I hate it when people make up words. Really, I usually do. But I was trying to avoid the word craft, because in a sense there's something which is post-craft and pre-Conrad. You know, there's a gap there between the two. There's something which is actually the Conrad sensibility would have walked into this and thought, goodness me, I couldn't make money out of that. There are certain combinations of surface and material, certain kind of geometric structures, certain kind of quirkiness about the hanging and the kind of curatorial approach. But it's kind of post-craft and pre-Conrad. And I really think that's a really interesting place to be. And that's why I thought it was in transition, in a sense. And your works often are kind of perforated in some way, or eroded, as if they're actually the subject of that transition.
Well, I've always been interested in art which sort of proposes a sense of time passing, and that somehow there's evidence in the making of something that it's not a miracle, but it is part of a process. And so, and time, I think, is incredibly important in the making of something. One coda to this is that one of the great pleasures of this whole project has been working in the foundry at Chelsea, where I've been allowed to play, and the technical staff at Chelsea have been absolutely wonderful in allowing me to muck about. Normally in foundries, you take your stuff to the door and you collect it 3 or 4 months later and you're a lot shorter with cash. But there is something about playing and making and being involved in that kind of process, and the way that time is so embedded within the casting process, that's been really, really important. And I've tried to sort of retain that in the kind of patination and certain rawness, you know, that they're not polished up and made to look as if they've been untouched. They are touched and they evolve.
Well, we'll overlook the health and safety issues, all right.
Yes.
But there is an issue, I think, about the technical or the handmade. I'm going to hang on to that for a moment. And the period in which most of this work was made, in the sense that it was a time when the idea of mastery or craft had already been challenged from the end of the 19th century and throughout the 20th. And by this time, then. The liberated brush or the chisel or whatever had come into full force. Mm. But in a sense, craft became rather like, I'm trying to think of the novel, but it's rather like that elderly, irritating relative in a family who gets plucked off eventually because they're just too much trouble, buried in the back garden. But you never can forget them because their absence is notable. And I think technique and craft in British art education, for example, is rather like the buried elderly relative, yes. who's certainly buried and certainly dead and gone, but can't be forgotten somehow. And a spectre-like emerges every now and again. And I felt that rather like walking around here was that there was lots of examples of the complete abolition of the kind of the canon of technique. But on the other hand, you chose a number of techniques such as bronze casting, however much you play it down, which you could have made it out of straw. So in a way, you chose certain things which were redolent of a kind of technique and a kind of history that sat against some works here, which are really quite casual, informal in their execution.
That's a very good point.
I didn't worry about that one.
I think in making, it's a kind of coming together with a notion in one's head, with also the intelligence at the end of your fingers. And I think that I suppose I was brought up very much within that tradition of learning to make, and I value that very much. But I want my things to be made sufficiently that they carry the idea, but not in such a way that that is what you first encounter. They're kind of rather almost like thinking models for me. That's how I would approach it. But I've always had a huge respect for people that can make things. I mean, from my own background, you know, from a very early age, I watched my father making stuff. And making stuff seemed the greatest form of play and fun that I, you know, I mean, my as a child, I had two places of absolute pleasure that I can tell you about. One was about an 18-inch square piece of wood, which was my plasticine board. And this meant that the plasticine was theoretically contained within the board and not in the carpet. But this was absolutely wonderful. And the other place was my dad's garage, where we made everything from the furniture to guitar cases, and where I learnt about what tools felt like in the hand. And there are things, those pleasures, I'm very reluctant to give up.
No. Well, I see no reason why you should, right? let's just move on a little bit to talk about the approach you took to this particular project.
Yeah.
Like it's got a lifelong period almost. I mean, yeah. One thing occurred to me when I read your very good essay, and also one by you, which I think is very illuminating, in the catalogue, was that there was a struggle to find the right terminology for what you were doing here, for what it was you were about. Mm. Not what the work was about, what you were about as an artist coming here to do that. Mm. And I say there were familiar terms like intervention. Mm. You use a particularly important term, which is called weaving the work in, which is kind of interwovenness of the work within the place, which I think slightly understates its role in the setting of this place. And let me give you one example of, or two examples of where it works in different ways. One is right at the top of the house, I think it was the children's room originally, which is flanked by drawings. And on one tabletop, there's a Gary Briska carving there, or a sculpture there. Yeah.
That's a nude.
Nude, that's right. Slightly contorted and not looking well. And over it, a portrait here. And to the left of that is your sculpture of a cot, a very linear, it's not a cot made up, it's a cot stripped bare in a sense. Yeah. And because that room, as you told me, was the place where the children slept, in a sense, that was your reference point. But something about that placing of that cot in that room next to that sculpture, it undoes the sculpture. And I've not seen that a lot before. It's not intervention, it doesn't rudely abuse it. It just sort of undoes it in a gentle way. The kind of axe looks rather false. Mm. And your statement looks rather, in a sense, simple but very knowing. Whereas in other places, that's my first example, in other places, if you take the Christopher Wood painting, that wonderful wood painting in the back of the room there, with the echoes in the vessel, the kind of edge of it, which is a wonderful visual echo between the two things. And they smile nicely at each other. There's a gentle exchange, there's a gentle interwovenness about that. Upstairs, I think there's an undoing going on.
Yeah. what my approach was. I mean, it always takes me a long time with most of my projects. That I start off with fanciful ideas, and then gradually things drop. And Michael was very patient. Politely replying to some of my more fantastic proposals, and gradually things calmed down. But one of the real issues for me about dealing with a place like Cattleshard is that it's not only a house, it's not only a collection, it's actually the intellectual masterpiece of Junaid. So in a way, one's dealing with a totality, and how to. So, as an artist, I have to kind of respect that the integrity of this artwork that one's going to sort of engage with. But on the other hand, you've got to elbow a bit of space. You know, I mean, otherwise you just lay down and die in front of it. So it was, I suppose, in a way, that's why I framed the project around this title, I called While You Were Out. It's as if I wanted to kind of feel as if I sneaked in and, you know, moved something here, put something there. It was those little sort of questions. The other thing about the undoing that you mentioned, and I've only just sort of thought about this in the light of what we were talking about, is that most of the images of women here are quite voluptuous. You know, Claudia Breschen's sculptures, you know, these are not anorexic figures. You know, there's, you know, a bit of meat on them. But there's also, they're quite idealized as well. You know, there's a sense of these sort of round mother figures that I suppose, you know, Henry Moore developed further and things like that. I suppose my view of motherhood is very different. It's in terms of work, it's in terms of labour, it's in terms of domesticity. So it's those kind of contradictions that I think sort of came about.
That domestic setting is important because again it's largely because of the absence of a number of telltale signs of domesticity, which you've reintroduced. Or I think in some of the open structures you've had there, you let the wind blow through them in a way. It's almost as if they're there as kind of spectres of a domestic setting, but actually have been eroded by time. I mean, the ones right behind where you are now, the familiar shaped vessels on the shelf there. I mean, either they're being kind of captured or eroded, and I can never quite be sure which it is. So there's a kind of temporal thing there, which is that bit of the domestic that's not here kind of gets into it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, that was the other thing. That if one starts thinking about the kettle jar as a house that's lived in, then there are certain questions that come up about what's been edited out. You know, for the... and I suppose, in a way, this is coming back to Roger's point about this being a house in transition, that there's the... you know, on one hand, it proposes that it's a house. On the other hand, the dirty bits of being in a house have been removed. And also, the evidence of children have been removed. You know, there's lots of evidence of Alfred Wallace with his little boats, but there isn't the toy boat that the children would have played with. And so these are some of the bits where I feel I can come in and start to suggest some of those absences that perhaps also throw a light on the way that Kettle Jar presents itself, or the way that Jim Eade presented the house.
And you can't anticipate it, surely. You know, the experience of, as I had earlier on when I first walked in here this afternoon, standing in the upstairs lavatory next to two women speaking in mid-European tongue I didn't recognise, whilst I was looking at Alfred Wallace painting. I mean, that's something you couldn't possibly
anticipate. But I mean, the fact that he would take undergraduates round between 2 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that the house was open while it was being lived in, is also something I find, you know, very, very interesting. So it's something I sort of touch on in my essay. Most houses, public houses, are frozen at the moment that the person dies or leaves. There's a sense that Kettle Jar has been captured while the person was still here, as indeed he was. Now, that actually throws up a really interesting notion about Kettle Jar. I mean, this, you know, Kettle Jar isn't a consequence of Jim Eade having been here for so many years and then gone. This is something that has been made. It is a fabrication. And that's what I find very, very interesting.
and a different category, say, from if you go to St Ives and go around Barbara Hepburn's house, which is, it's just not even vaguely any longer a house, and it was not livable in this current form. It's called house, but in fact it's a museum.
Yes. So,
or indeed the, what's that thing, the Francis Bacon studio that was taken to Dublin, that actually reinstalled there with every champagne cork and cigarette end neatly numbered. And in a sense, this has not done that. It's not done that kind of, it's meticulous, but it's not forensic. Sense.
No.
You know, there's a kind of forensic element of the Francis Bacon bit.
Yes.
Whereas here, it's kind of meticulous but not forensic, with that cold hand of science on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think my view of Kettlechard oscillated as I was working on the project, and I think this is often something that happens when you engage in something, that you actually have to find things you don't like to give yourself space to move. Because, I mean, you know, otherwise you just become a fan, and that's a rather sad state to be in. So, I mean, it was exactly the same when I did when I worked on the curating the Mirandi show a couple of years ago. I had to find things in Mirandi I really didn't like, and in order to be able to engage. I've rather lost my track.
I think that's not a bad end to that sentence.
Oh, right.
And also, I wanted to, because we need leave a little time for people to ask questions. So, I wanted to go on a bit to the kind of back to the curatorial issue again, and talk about the idea of a kind of civilizing space and something that actually was seen, certainly by Jimmy, as something that was the brought meaning and value and a kind of pose to contemporary life, and the extent to which really that vision for this location is a curatorial approach that shaped you, or did you feel that in a sense you were coming from a different age and a different viewpoint?
I suppose sort of referring back to what I was saying earlier, you know, one is aware that certain things have been edited out that might have challenged the kind of aesthetic, but what started to occur to me, and also reading Jim Eade's writing as well, is that there is something sort of intensely religious about the whole concept of Kettlechard. Even the fact that the different kind of spaces that are organised and the way chairs are laid out, almost like as lady chapels. The fact that the way that light and space is utilised is a way that you probably have to find an equivalent in cathedrals or churches. I mean, it's something that I suppose is in the kind of contemporary setting, that sense of light and space has taken on a new dimension in architecture in the last 10 or 15 years, with, you know, new possibilities being opened up through, you know, materials that we can use. But I do kind of get the feeling that somehow there's an underlying quest for the sublime here, you know, or God, or, you know, that in establishing perfect relationships or meaningful relationships, I feel that he's trying to suggest something beyond. I mean, that's from my position, that's something I'd find quite, I wouldn't be able to particularly see, but I do feel that very, very strongly, that there is a real desire to communicate something that can transcend people, enable people to transcend their everyday situation.
I suppose that's true in the sense that it's a collection of ephemera beyond the pictures and the sculpture and show that chance. Because in most domestic settings, certainly in my own, then the domestic accident actually has as much aesthetic value as the intentionally collected piece of piece of art that you've bought from somewhere. The fact that I think in my conservatory at the moment is there's a whole stack of pots which I put together very hastily. when I was emptying pots out for it to repot them, and they become a kind of sculptural totem in the corner because it kind of looks pretty good. Now that's kind of accident doesn't happen here. There's a kind of consciousness here, isn't there? An aesthetic alive in this process.
Yeah. But I suppose one of the most profound things for me about Jimmy's vision is the way that what he's, in the end, what he says is that anything, no matter how mundane, can be beautiful or significant or perfect, depending on where it's placed, its juxtaposition. So, I mean, in a way, the juxtapositions in the house are extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, groups of pebbles that are of no financial value have been laid out as if they are precious stones. You know, and from what I understand, if any of those stones were moved, then Jim would probably kill you or something. You know, I mean, I remember speaking to Jeremy Lucen, who was one of the curators here many years ago, who said that he had a year-long correspondence with Jim Ead when he tried to move a pot 3 foot. So, you know, there is that. So, you know, you have this, you know, the object that has no intrinsic value next to a painting, you know, like, say, Ben Lucas's Argos, that is hugely valuable. And for me, at a time when the only time that art is spoken about, it seems to be in terms of its financial value, I do find there's something incredibly refreshing about these juxtapositions and way things have been collected.
I think that's a really good point just to pause on, Paul, because it's a really useful observation, and maybe a point also where if people do have comments or questions, they'd like to raise them. It's usually the point at which the room goes completely silent. But we've locked the door.
Yeah. You didn't come here tabula rasa. You have a head full of theory, not just practice, and not just two eyes, and not just two hands, but a head bursting like the man before Dylan's song with theory. What the most obvious theory, with or without inverted commas, would be Baudelaire and the quote. And, say something about the theory you brought here and how maybe it was modified in turn once you had got.
Well, Baudelaire's Poets of Space was a kind of key bit of reading. I mean, in a way, it could almost be the commentary for Kettle Jar. I mean, sort of in that he sort of very poetically articulates very different kinds of spaces and our emotional things about, and also writes very beautifully about the idea of the house. I suppose, in a way, the house is a setting, and also the house is something that means something in terms of family and things like that has always been very important to me, even when I didn't have one. When I didn't have a house, I had a thought of a house in my head, which I carried around as a kind of nomad. The other thing that I thought about a lot was Iceman's Against Nature as the total antithesis of Kettle Jard. I mean, there, the hero of the book, Nezesian, goes about collecting everything imaginable in the world to create the most indulgent space that permeates every sense. You know, and then there's this wonderful... do you all know this? Shall I just tell you the last little bit? Anyway, he ends up by, you know, he gets rugs from Persia and everything like this, and it's dripping with the senses. And he looks at all and thinks, this is great, but it needs something to set it off. So he goes out and gets a tortoise to go on the Persian rug, this grey tortoise. And he thinks, this is great, but not quite right. So he takes the tortoise to the jeweler. And then there's about 3 or 4 pages describing the jewels that are encrusted on this poor soul's shell, and then puts the tortoise back on the carpet, and it moves a couple of steps and then dies of a heart attack because of the weight of the jewels. And that seems to be so much the opposite of here. But you know, sometimes it's often useful just to think of opposites in order to find out what you do.
You talked about in order to orientate yourself, you had to decide there were things that you didn't like.
Yeah.
I was so intrigued to find out what you didn't like.
The kind of obsessive fixity is something, I mean, if any of you have ever seen the way I work, it is pretty chaotic. And stuff does sort of go all over the place, and I lose things and things. The idea of something having only one place and being set in a particular relationship is something that, I find sort of, quite difficult. So I did want my things to have more fluidity. But I'm sure Jim would have found me rather sloppy in contrast.
I'm not sure I asked a question, but I was wondering how your own personal experience, your own personal domestic situation has come into this work. Because you talk about domestic situation, but it doesn't seem to come from nowhere. I just wonder how much your own personal natural situation comes into it.
Well, actually, I think that's a very interesting question, Keir. I haven't been an artist that has sort of craved what would normally be seen of as a studio. I've always worked best in kind of odd domestic places. And for the most part, I make my stuff on the run. Even when I get a studio, I don't generally work in it. And it's a strategy that I've used to kind of catch myself out. Because as soon as I start putting on the smock and the berry and getting the thing that I call studio, I start thinking what I'm doing is I'm making art. And it always just looks like what everybody else does. And it's only by sort of, I want to kind of surprise myself and do things that I'm not quite sure, quite where it fits. And so in some ways, making work in a house for another house makes me very happy. So, and I could test, I tested this stuff out in my house, and it, in the end, it's probably all about me anyway. So it's me in my house, I suppose.
This becomes a kind of theme, doesn't it? I mean, you've made work for specific settings now. A few times, you talk about Mirandi, and I haven't been. I've visited Mirandi's house
in
Bologna, and seen just what you couldn't do with that place, and how little it tells you in a sense about what he might do. I mean, would the next step be when somebody's in making the work? Don't wait until they leave and pass away. You could take it over while they're still there.
I think I'll just have to wait for offers. So if any of you are going away for a few months and just let me know. You better mark your valuables.
With your also chaotic nature or way of working, would you have been upset if anyone went around and moved what you've put here?
That's a very good question. I'd probably move it back. I get kind of quite itchy when I sort of go around that I probably want to start touching the stuff again. I mean, it's always very strange when you make work and everything is fluid and up for grabs and you can move everything. And then there's a point when you kind of commit yourself and then it leaves you. And I suppose this work is a little bit too close. I wouldn't say it's left me yet because it's really been only in the last week that I've really been able to really see if things have worked or not, things like that. But what I do find is that then quite rapidly there is a point where that work becomes then part of the past. and you know, you just move on. That doesn't mean I don't have an affection for it anymore, but it's not. You've just got to keep the water moving, really. Set new challenges.
A lot of work is also, as I said earlier, kind of structurally open.
Yeah.
And they're either containers that don't contain anymore.
Yeah.
So they, in a sense, they've lost their right to permanence in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of them I see it's almost like three-dimensional drawings.
Yeah.
And you know, almost like trying to sketch something in space.
The work you do on the computer
yeah.
is sort of halfway between the two, isn't it?
Yeah.
That suits you down to the ground, or down up to the screen.
Yeah, yeah. I've had to find ways of working with the computer that I use very, very few options. And in a way I try and strip it down so that then it's my imagination that has to do the work. Otherwise, you sit there clicking different filters, and the world changes wonderfully in front of you, but it's somehow it becomes very detached. So I'm always, I think I sort of have a kind of compulsion to pull in order to expand out. And that goes back to Baccarat as well. You know, the notion in the way of the poetic imagination, is... I mean, in a way, one has those sort of models of, the Saint Jerome in his cell, you know, where really it's an intellectual space to dream, and there are all kinds of portals through which the imagination goes through: books, windows, relationships with the animals, and things like that. So I find those things.
Were the prints harder to introduce than the I would have thought they'd be a lot harder to introduce, because the majority of the book is war-based.
Yeah, yeah. And also the relationships then become much more fixed.
Yeah.
But the other thing that is always very interesting about a project like this is, as an artist, I think you always have a hankering to know what your work would look like against stuff you really like. You know, we intellectually sort of say, oh, you know, my work's influenced by blah, 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 blah. You know, but I always think it would be wonderful to test that out. You know, I've always liked William Scott's work. And I was determined that the William Scott would stay up there because I wanted to see if my work would fall off the wall next to it. So these are the ways, as an artist, that you test out your propositions. And sometimes it can be a bit disturbing. You know, sometimes things do fall off the wall, and so you go back to the drawing board. But I think that there is also something. Going back to the importance of Kettle Jar, in a time when so much art is communicated through reproduction, Kettle Jar proposes ways of looking at things that are very, very precise. And as an artist, I mean, and the way that I learn about my language is testing things out in real situations. And if I have a chance to do it next to real work, that's great for me.
But it's interesting, isn't it, how, just with the 2 minutes next to Scott, we were talking earlier on how little, very small kind of detail signifiers actually shift the work along from kind of framing conventions and all of those things, even siding conventions within the business, really just differentiated in a very kind of stark way. Much more so, I think, in two-dimensional than in three-dimensional work, in a sense, which you can subtly kind of ease into the background and incorporate. I was at a gallery in a couple of gallery openings in Ireland a few weeks ago, and there were just two beautiful spaces that were actually in townhouses, rather elegant townhouses in Ireland. And I was talking to one of the directors of the gallery and saying how nice it was to actually have a change from the kind of white cube, the gallery, which is the norm these days, and see art again built into what were rather grand townhouses. And he said, well, actually, he said, it's good business sense, really. He said, because people come in here, they'll see the work on the wall, and they think, that could be my house. Well, they could fantasize it might be their house, even if it wasn't their house. Whereas if it's in a big white box, then they'll never have a house like that, or very few of them will, and therefore they don't buy. So there's a kind of commercial reality in that process too.
Well, it's a commercial plug all the works for sale. So, so if you're fantasizing, then it's, maybe it's within your grasp.
Are there any more? If not, thank you.
To talk to me today, but also I didn't have a chance last Saturday to really thank Michael and everyone at Kettle Jar for hosting me. It's been a very happy time.